if this contribution vanishes, then you get, if you make this first formula explicit, a warded entity of space-time supersymmetry. So maybe I just wanted to say a word about what pictures mean here. But I think it's, I don't like to take too much time because there also should be a lot of questions on Eric's talk. I'm not sure I can truly see a quick enough explanation that's illuminating, but I'll try to say something rather simple. When we add an inverse Schwarz vertex operator, we add dimension 1/1 to the moduli space. And remember that whenever we want to integrate over an extra odd modulus, we need picture number -1. So the NS vertex operator should have picture number -1 for a simple formalism, just because the insertion of the puncture adds one odd dimension to the moduli space. Remember, the picture number of something we can't integrate is minus the odd dimension. So if we increase the odd dimension by 1 because there's a vertex operator, we must change the picture number by -1. The vertex operator must carry picture number -1. So there's a detail I'm hiding, but it's easier to explain the detail if we start with the Raman case. So I've tried to draw those little things which are meant to suggest Raman divisors, because remember, the Raman divisor is really a divisor, not a point, unlike an inverse Schwarz vertex operator, which is a point. And if you work out the dimension of moduli space, you'll find that, well, first of all, when you add a pair of Raman divisors, you add 2/1 to the dimension of moduli space. So adding the pair of Raman divisors adds 2 bosonic moduli, but only 1 fermionic modulus. So there's a fermionic dimension of 1/2 for each Raman puncture. And that suggests that you should use picture number -1/2. And that's actually the most simple value. If you you see, I didn't really have time to explain much about the moduli space of super Riemann surfaces, but if you want to calculate superstring scattering amplitudes by integrating on the moduli space of super Riemann surfaces as I've defined them, then the Raman vertex operators need picture number -1/2. But you can ask the following question. When I tell you that a super Riemann surface with Raman divisors has these specified divisors, the thought might cross your mind that you might want to pick a point on each such divisor. If you pick a point on a Raman divisor, you're adding one more odd modulus. So a Raman divisor with a point chosen on it has added 3/2 odd moduli. So we could work on a different moduli space of super Riemann surfaces, where the super Riemann surface is endowed with the choice of a point at some or all of the odd moduli, at some or all of the Raman divisors. Whenever there's a Raman divisor that does have a point chosen on it, it's actually added 3/2 to the odd dimension. So here, you should use a vertex operator of picture number -3/2. So there's a different moduli space. So there's an MG with some Nevers-Schwartz punctures and some Ramon punctures. But over it, there's a bigger moduli space, where the fiber is a copy of C01 for every Ramon puncture at which we decided to pick a point. In other words, the Ramon divisors are themselves copies of C01. C01 is just a complex supermanifold with one odd dimension, no even ones. It's a divisor in our super Ramon surface. Picking a point on a Ramon divisor means creating a fiber bundle with a copy of C01 over associated to each puncture, or each puncture at which we decide to do this. So there's some other moduli space that's a fiber bundle over the standard one. If you want to calculate by integration over this bigger moduli space, you'll have to use vertex operators of picture number minus 3/2. You can do that. There are nice vertex operators of picture number minus 3/2 that you can use up here that were essentially constructed by Friedan, Martinek, and Schenker. How are the two related? Well, obviously, if you can write the superstring scattering amplitudes as integrals up here, then by integrating over the fibers of the map from here to here, you can get an expression down here. There's got to be a transformation from a formalism where you use vertex operators of picture number minus 3/2 to one where you use vertex operators of picture number minus 1/2. So that's the basic example, or that's the most simple to explain example, where there are different formalisms and a picture-changing transformation between them. In general, extending this, you can show that for any negative picture numbers, you can define a moduli space that's appropriate. So if you want to calculate with Nevers-Schwartz vertex operators of picture number minus 17, you can add some bells and whistles to the usual moduli space and get an appropriate moduli space that's suitable for calculating with vertex operators of picture number minus 17. Importantly, you can only do that for negative values of the picture number. So there are no picture number transformations from negative picture numbers to zero or positive picture numbers. Trying to do that is where people ran into mistakes in the 80s, actually. I think this might be a relatively reasonable place to stop, since there are other things we should discuss. So I'll just ask if there are questions. I probably didn't answer all the questions that were asked at the end of my talk, but I said something about some of them, at least.
Spin structures haven't answered yet. Is there, should I think of each spin structure being a different super Riemann surface?
Well, okay. The hypothesis, I didn't tell you how to construct super Riemann surfaces. I gave you the definition in a slightly abstract form. But the hypothesis that there is a completely unintegrable subbundle of the tension bundle lets you deduce a spin structure. So a super Riemann surface is always endowed with a spin structure. It's roughly because if an expression like this, well, since d by dz has spin 1, this formula forces d by d theta to have spin 1/2. And then it's only globally, remember it's only defined up to multiplying by a function, because we're really only interested in the subbundle of the tangent bundle it generates. But that subbundle is a spin bundle. Yes?
So what are the reasons to work with higher features? I mean, why wouldn't they just work with feature minus 1/2?
For most purposes, it's most natural to work with the canonical pictures -1/2 and -1. But if you want to know what the other pictures mean, I explained it for picture number -3/2, and there are similar, more general answers for all negative picture numbers. Sometimes people have relatively well-motivated reasons to study picture number -3/2. So I'm not telling you that you should consider the more negative values. I'm just telling you what they mean.
Does it make the moduli space simpler?
Well, abstractly, no, but there might be a concrete situation in which the answer would be yes.
Well, the disk with one puncture, of course.
Well, if you, Jamo is making a statement that in embryo is true, but If I was trying to explain it, unfortunately, it would be a long explanation. anyway, John is correctly referring to an example where not letting yourself talk about picture number minus 3/2 would be inconvenient. But still, I believe even there, you should start with canonical picture numbers and explain why, starting with some more physical amplitude and reducing to a disk with one puncture, you're motivated to consider minus 3/2. I tried to explain that in section 9 of my long paper. Any more reasonably quick questions? Okay. I'm happy here. I guess you don't want my cell phone.
Trade this microphone back and forth. Any questions? Discussions? Comments?
I'd like to say what puzzles me.
Okay.
And it's at the very beginning of your talk.
Okay.
So, unfortunately, this will be unhelpful, unlimiting. But you and Funk had a completely natural procedure to calculate the two-loop superstring measure and to get a simple formula for it. But I feel that to get the four-point function, you did an incredible calculation and got a simple answer. But you did not have any explanation of why there was a simple answer. See, unfortunately, what I've said will be a black box to most of you, because I don't know how many people really study the details of their work. I haven't even mentioned the concept of a splitting of a supermanifold, because we didn't have time to get there. But for the vacuum amplitude, your work was based on a natural splitting of the supermoduli space, a natural rate of integrator over the odd variables. But as far as I can see, in driving the four-point function, you rolled up your elbows and worked very hard, but you didn't have a natural rate.
Well, we tried a natural way later on, right? When you had suggested working with the vectors in the Jacobian, right, corresponding to
points.
That sounds very natural, and we...
It hasn't been done that way.
No, it hasn't been done that way, and we encountered a spurious singularity, which probably
it might turn out that
this
particular calculation, that isn't a problem.
That's right, right.
That hasn't been answered.
No, we haven't.
I have more of a comment than a question, which is that, to me, it would be wonderful.
Do you want a microphone? I mean, you...
I don't know.
Yeah, but
I think I'm talking loud enough.
Yeah, right.
So, to me, it would be really wonderful to have a nice explanation of that incredible formula you showed at the beginning of your talk.
What can I say? basically... you know, we were not aware of these simplifying possibilities earlier on, so we didn't really, you know, I mean, we knew the projection for the case of the measure and used that, and then once vertex operators are inserted, then, how should I say that? I mean, basically, you know, we knew how to organize the calculation, sort of, you know, spurious contributions which should integrate to zero on the Riemann surface, since we were not working directly in superspace, these cancellations had to be carried out in components, so that's more complicated.
Well, I'm afraid this is possibly too detailed a direction for this discussion. But I'd like to say that I actually don't understand how you were able to separate the two. I mean, you've explained it to me, but I think it would be wonderful to have a clearer explanation.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I think that you know, I mean, pursuing the idea of you know, projections, not just in the supermoduli space, but also in supermoduli space with punctures, in a sense, would be the right way to go. I think that's the only way I can imagine that you can simplify things. So, Not having done the calculations, a bit hard to say, but yes, it is a, you know, in the end, very simple, very natural formula. Almost as natural as genus one, given the fact that, you know, for genus one, the measure is, the volume form is straightforward. So you cannot, you need some more complicated volume form for genus two, which is sort of the simplest thing you can think of. Interestingly enough, I mean, people have tried to generalize by guessing, generalize this formula to genus three or higher, and that never really worked out. You can ask that question. You have a formula just for just a bosonic formulation, just an integral over bosonic moduli space at genus two. Could you just guess the answer for genus three?
I don't, people have done that for the measure, but have they done that for the
yes.
starting of
this? It never really worked.
Well, but again, this is, point is maybe a little too specialized, but the assumptions that were made for genus three, even for the measure,
mm-hmm.
look unnatural.
Right, mm-hmm. right. Uh-huh. So can I ask you a question then? I mean, in your paper on Ramon punctures and,
yes.
and superperiod matrix, you have a long appendix on genus three, which we corresponded about, right?
Yes.
So could this, I mean, you find the pole in a place you perhaps didn't, you know, expect.
Yes.
I mean, could one use that as a departure point for guessing, actually, the measure?
One should be able to do that.
Yeah. I mean,
so,
now you know there is a pole, so it's not as,
but
you know,
the,
it's a different.
Unfortunately, I doubt most people here have read that appendix, so this discussion will be opaque to most. But I'll just say that if there is a pole, that arises because the procedure of integration isn't correct.
Right.
It means you'll have to be careful about what you try to learn from the answer
right.
and get that
right. Right.
Probably you'll need to make a correction along that divisor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, but you should be able to guess, I mean, guess with the help of, you know, the knowledge of the known pole and so on and so forth. You should be able to guess what the measure is now, in fact.
The measure computed with that procedure.
Yes.
Uh-huh. What Eric is saying is, in genus 2, Delbert and Fong had a very nice procedure for integrating over the fermionic moduli and reducing to a measure on the ordinary moduli space. And to some extent, the procedure has an analog for genus 3. But if you look carefully, it seems that the procedure in genus 3 will produce a pole in the interior of moduli space, a slightly unphysical pole. In genus 2, there's a conspiracy. Everything works in your favor. And the projection works perfectly. The integrated answer is zero. Well,
yes, okay. But you're after the measure. I mean, you want to use the measure.
The integrated, well, actually, from space-time supersymmetry, you know, the integrated answer will be zero, and that is independent of exactly how you calculate it. However, Dokken and Fong had a way to calculate it that was pretty natural in genus zero. And they showed that with their procedure, the sum over spin structures is zero even before integrating. So in the paper Eric is mentioning, I actually explained that using more detailed facts about genus 2 with Ramon punctures.
So if we went to genus 3, you identified the measure. I mean, one should be able to show the vanishing of the, you know, integral of the measure there too.
Well,
I mean, that would be a good test of knowing how to handle the singularity.
I'm afraid once your procedure or its analogs in our genus starts developing singularities, it might quickly become less useful.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm extremely puzzled about what could be a higher genus analog of what you told us today, because you had these nice differential equations.
Yes.
So differential equations on bosonic moduli space make sense, but it's hard
right.
to see how to reduce to bosonic moduli space. But I really can't see what could be similar differential equations on super moduli space.
Right. That's why I was limited to genus two. I mean, and even the most natural generalization like this Jean Kawazumian invariant, which exists at all genera, even at genus three, is definitely not the right object.
But it's a little bit hard to believe your story in genus 1 and 2 completely goes away in higher order.
Right.
But I just can't imagine the generalization.
because of the delta functions in the.
Well, because the natural structure is really supermodulized space, right?
So, why can I write down differential equations?
Well, for type zero superstring theory, for type zero non-superstring theory, you could write down differential equations in supermodulized space. Because modulized space would be a supermanifold, which in that case is actually real, and has a metric similar to the metric you were using. And then you could write down the Laplacian aspect of that metric. But in superstring theory, I think you can't do that, because there's no real structure for the odd moduli. In particular, for type 2, which Eric was talking about, the left-moving supermoduli are definitely not the complex conjugates of the right-moving supermoduli. Mm-hmm. So when you write a Laplacian, it's d by d m bar, where m and m bar are homomorphic and anti-homomorphic moduli. But I don't think you can write a d by d alpha, d by d beta, where alpha and beta are homomorphic and anti-homomorphic supermoduli, because you don't have any way to pair them up. They just live in different spaces.
Yes, but then, I mean, the analog could be Jift to Cauchy-Riemann type equation with Jift.
Well, you know, your question is not.
No, that's true, but the equation I wrote down was only on the purely bosonic part. You could have, I would assume, you know, an accompanying equation for the supermoduli, which is purely homomorphic.
A purely homomorphic equation sounds too simple.
No, with the right-hand side, would you have a delta function or something? I mean, I could imagine. Well, we're completely
Well, I'm only saying I can't imagine.
Right. No, I mean, and we haven't really very much tried to imagine it, so I can't really, you know, be more specific. Yes.
The alpha plan expansion at one loop, you discussed this D4 function, and where I understood that you are on a good track of proving your claim how to reduce D4 to simple objects.
Yes.
And in this proof, you talked about a slicing, how you pull out the Tartu dependence and isolate the pure Q series at different
powers.
Is this just a tool or a trick to carry out a particular proof? Or could it be a worthwhile organizing principle that there are some more fundamental objects which are pure Q series and which are then somehow decorated with Tartus?
Well, they're Q series, they're not modular invariant, of course, because you need the Y component to make up for the modular invariance of the whole. That structure persists for higher div and higher, you know, it's just the boundaries, right? We went from a specific negative power in the Lorentz series to a specific positive power. Those powers will grow with the weight, and we know exactly how they grow. And we can probably even prove it. I mean, we haven't really spent much time on it, but I'm sure that can be proven for every single diagram. But this way of proceeding with the proof for D4, which let's assume it works for the moment, if not complete, would be very difficult to generalize. I mean, just the complexity of the calculation is beyond, you know, I mean, what I would normally consider doable. So there must be a better proof. So I think, you know, our next, once we know that it's true, it need, logically speaking, not be true. There is the possibility of having a cuspoidal function sit in there. But let's assume that it's true, then I think the first order of business is to find a better way of proving it.
Okay.
Not obvious, but.
Just in case you do this kind of slicing to various of these objects you discussed, are there, let's say, enjoyed formula for the structure of the Q expansion?
Yes, there's some beautiful formulas. I don't have them on a transparency, but. yes, the final formula is surprisingly simple, actually.
Divisor sums in a prominent row? The divisor sums in a prominent row?
What does that mean, divisor sums?
Sigma divisor sums.
Oh, that's not the way I do it, but yes, you could rewrite it that way, yes. Yes, David?
Is there any possibility to check the instant correction?
You mean space-time instant?
Yes, it demands one brain.
Yeah, that would be, yes, I think that would actually be very interesting, yes. We haven't really thought about it much, but yes, I think that would be interesting.
You mean the instanton?
The D1 instanton.
I mean the target space.
Yeah.
The one
a certain amount of that's been done in the, I guess, I'm not sure what I'm going to
talk I think he about. Means the perturbative correction around the instanton, right?
You know, like for blue, for gravitons in the presence of D-1 brain. To compute e to the minus 2 pi tau.
So his tau is big, is the world tau.
Yeah. No, I'm talking about the.
Yeah.
You know, the after the fork.
Right. No, that's okay. So I guess I will say a little bit about that tomorrow.
Questions? Other questions? Comments? Yes.
Please go ahead. I have a general question, maybe elementary question, since I'm not a string theorist. It's about you mentioned several times that somehow if you were in the Lorentzian case, the derivative of theta would be simpler, and yes. Somehow the splitting would be simpler. And so I wonder, in the recent work that has been done, this understanding the supermoduli, how much does that bring us closer to, you know, or is it related to understanding somehow some kind of the worksheet in a Lorentzian manner? How does that relate to the old work of Mandelstam and Giddings Wolpert?
Well, I'll just say that the problem with a Lorentzian worksheet is that it would be singular.
Yes. So you will have to understand the type of singularity, where they are, and how these are labeled by.
Yes, but it looks very, to me personally, it looks rather unpleasant. Okay. I'm not going to personally go in that direction.
Yes, I think that's a very, you know, it's very tempting, but actually to resolve the singularities you get in the light cone gauge is
the beauty of the standard approach is that string theory is manifestly free of ultraviolet divergences because there's no ultraviolet region in the moduli space. Mm-hmm. But as Eric was starting to say, if you try to use Lorentz signature worksheets, mm-hmm. ultraviolet findings will be completely unclear. Mm-hmm.
Yes, you showed various examples how you can reduce more difficult graphs on the worksheet to simpler ones.
Mm-hmm.
And can you somehow make sense of these identities in terms of graph operations, like nodes, edges?
Yes, that's an excellent question, actually. I mean, you could ask the very simple question, these things were defined as sums, multiple sums. Is there some basic rearrangement of the sum that does that? And I can give you a partial answer. For example, for the simplest identity that I mentioned, where you know you have this graph, just the sunset graph, is given by E3 plus zeta of 3. Okay, that's the simplest, which was already computed by Zagier before we did it. Now, this you can immediately see you could never get by rearranging the sum, because you could never get that zeta 3. Okay. On the other hand, if you apply the Laplace operator, then in fact, for this case, it can be shown with the help of rearranging elementary rearrangements of the sum. But if you go beyond that, then again, using Maple, you can do a lot of trial and error, and it does not seem that that's possible.
What was Zagier's explanation of what he was doing when he did that calculation?
His explanation?
And what did it mean to Zagier?
You mean number theoretically, or Michael, you corresponded with him more. So.
I read the paper with Pierre Van Hoven and another researcher, which Zagier had an appendix to. Mm-hmm. And in reading his appendix, he came across another appendix where we had written down that function, but we hadn't evaluated it. And as far as I know, that's the only reason he evaluated it. I don't know. I don't know what it is.
It's unpublished, I think. Right?
It's an unpublished set of notes, which are remarkable in the sense that he's a wizard at doing these sums.
I'm not sure if I understand. The diagram is a centered Feynman diagram for a massless propagator?
For a massless.
Massless,
and you there is no zero mode.
What?
No zero mode. You remove the zero mode, yeah. String theory does that for you. But so when you just think in terms of Feynman diagrams, it's a propagator without the zero mode. So this... yes, this Feynman diagram is equal to E3 is really this Feynman diagram, right, with 3 points, and then plus a constant. So to answer Oliver's question, this constant you could never get. That's from rearranging sums.
Let's say I was also hoping to get into more abstract direction of graph operations. Say multiple zeta values are known to have a Hopf algebra structure. And at the same time, Kreimer et al. Have worked on Hopf algebra structures for graphs. Maybe there's some adventurous connection that one might make.
I have nothing to say. I mean, it would be fascinating, but. There is a whole, I mean, as of course you know, for these multi-zeta values, so the multi-zeta functions evaluated at positive integers, it's called multi-zeta values, there's a whole literature, there's a whole world out there actually on finding the generators of that ring of such things. And so for sufficiently low values of the arguments, these multiple zeta values can be expressed as polynomials in ordinary zeta functions evaluated at integers, but that stops at some level, I forget, 11 or something, or yeah. And then you need, you know, intrinsically multi zeta valued functions. So that, I mean, you know, we have not pursued that, but so the question is, in a sense, what is the modeler analog of that, which is our, you know, the equations we have come across.